Welcome to the debate. Imagine an unknown, independent researcher just emerges out of nowhere, claiming he hasn't just solved the deepest mysteries of quantum physics, but has also found the exact location of $15.87 trillion in the global economy.
Right. A casual Tuesday for an independent researcher.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot. But it really begs the question, right? Is this the work of an absolute genius who has fundamentally exposed our systemic ignorance? Or is it just the tragic, naive vanity of a fool who, you know, doesn't really understand how the real world works?
And that is exactly the core tension we are looking at today. We are unpacking the staggering 2026 intellectual output of an independent researcher named Sid J. A. Hubbard. Over the course of just a few months, he has released frameworks claiming to resolve the Hubble tension in cosmology, mathematically bound quantum singularities, and, as you said, map exactly where global capital is being suffocated by institutional failure.
It is a massive amount of material, and we're framing our discussion today around a very specific literary and psychological question raised by all this work. Is Sid J. A. Hubbard an idiot in the classical sense of Prince Lev Mishkin from Dostoevsky's novel The Idiot?
A great comparison, honestly.
Right? Like, does he possess a startling, tragically hopeful innocence that leads him to attempt beautiful but impossible interventions in a highly cynical world? Or did he actually crack the most difficult problems in human history, which would mean we are the idiots for continuing to operate in broken zero-sum paradigms?
Well, I'm going to argue that Hubbard is the modern embodiment of Prince Mishkin. He is presenting a radical innocence that fatally misreads how the world's calculations of power, pride, and even physical realities actually operate. It's a breathtakingly innocent attempt to cure a sick society through pure structural grace. But ultimately, I think it's an aesthetic vanity.
Yeah, I see it entirely differently. I will be arguing that Hubbard's framework, what he calls nested causal modeling, is a legitimate, rigorous revelation.
Rigorous?
Highly rigorous. He is not naive at all. His theories effectively enclose and solve our most intractable problems by mapping how causality actually works. He has provided a roadmap for immediate, real-world prosperity, and his refusal to play our aggressive, zero-sum games is an act of high-level genius, not innocence.
Well, look, let's test that genius in the real world first, before we get to the cosmos. Let's look at his economics. You mentioned the $15.87 trillion.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody can throw a trillion-dollar figure on a white paper and call it a revelation. How is he actually arriving at that number without just guessing?
He isn't guessing at all. He uses a deeply rigorous framework called the RTLDI Atlas, which stands for the Right to Life Deficit Index.
Okay.
He takes hard open source data from the VDEM Institute and the World Bank, and he maps capital exclusions across all 193 UN member states. So he basically defines a capital exclusion as a place where money is shut out of productive use simply because 9 foundational right to life protections are missing.
Right. Okay. But how does he quantify a missing legal protection into a specific dollar amount of lost GDP? That seems like a massive leap.
By using a strictly bounded equation, he applies a population-weighted sensitivity coefficient, which is set at 0.30.
Ooh, which means what exactly for the listener?
To put that in perspective, that coefficient basically measures how responsive an economy is to its own human capital. He factors in population size and density to calculate how much economic potential is unlocked when you simply protect the people doing the work.
Ah, I see.
But, you know, to prevent the math from just spiraling out of control, he caps the economic projection at 25% of a nation's observed GDP.
Which he calls the institutional cap, right?
Correct, yeah. It's a highly conservative limiter. He ensures these 9 indicators are never credited with more than a quarter of a nation's wealth, which gives due weight to other vital economic factors like existing industry structure, natural resources, trade routes, things like that.
Okay, so what are the actual findings?
Well, under this math, Northern America is losing over $3 trillion annually, and the United States accounts for $2.87 trillion of that, just due to gaps in socioeconomic conditions and legal protections.
Wow.
Yeah, it's massive. Meanwhile, Central Asia is losing $121.5 billion, heavily tied to failures in mechanisms protecting civilians in conflict zones and prohibitions on arbitrary detention.
And see, that framing right there is precisely where I think Hubbard's idiocy is most glaring. You just perfectly outlined his innocence.
How is relying on VDEM data innocent?
Because of the Dostoevsky parallel. In The Idiot, Prince Myshkin refused to participate in the social economy of pride and resentment. He just assumed everyone merely wanted to be good, and his radical candor completely disrupted the society of 1860 St. Petersburg. Hubbard is doing the exact same thing with global finance.
I don't follow.
He assumes autocrats and bureaucrats will simply look at this $15.87 trillion figure and suddenly enact whistleblower protections or end arbitrary detention out of rational self-interest.
Well, I mean, the math objectively proves those regimes are losing money by maintaining those abuses.
But he is ignoring the fact that regimes often willingly sacrifice GDP to maintain autocratic control, you know? Intimacy and reputation in Dostoevsky's salons were brokered like capital, and sincerity actually wounded people because it stripped away their protective masks.
Right, but we're talking about global markets here, not a 19th century salon.
The human element is the same, though. Hubbard thinks that showing a dictator an atlas that says, "You are losing $100 billion because you lack law enforcement accountability," will prompt a structural reform. It's breathtakingly naive. The absence of those protections isn't a mistake waiting to be fixed by a better map. It is a deliberate feature of coercive power. He treats a sick society as if it just misplaced its instruction manual.
I hear your point, but let me offer a different perspective. You're treating Hubbard like a man showing a map of buried treasure to a dragon, assuming he somehow doesn't see the dragon sitting on the gold.
That's exactly what he's doing.
But what if his map is actually designed to change the water supply the dragon drinks from?
I'm sorry, how does an open source atlas change the water supply?
Because he isn't asking for the autocrat's permission. He's altering the structural causality of the wider economy. By publishing this atlas, using verified data, he makes the exact dollar amount of excluded capital visible to the outside world, to foreign investors, international NGOs, trade partners.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Right? He bypasses the autocrat's internal logic and changes the external boundary conditions of their economy. Once global markets can precisely quantify the inefficiency of a regime's cruelty, the cost of doing business changes.
That assumes making vulnerability highly visible actually inspires investment or positive intervention.
Why wouldn't it?
Because, in fact, if you quantify exactly how unprotected capital is in a region like, say, Eastern Africa, where the atlas shows $18.9 billion lost entirely due to failures in socioeconomic conditions like healthcare and food, you might just trigger massive capital flight.
Oof.
Yeah. Myshkin's radical transparency unsettled everyone and ultimately provoked bitter rivalries. Hubbard's transparency might just optimize adverse selection, you know, telling investors exactly which countries to abandon.
That is a fair concern, definitely. Though I would frame his transparency a bit differently. Hubbard isn't just pointing out flaws to scare capital away. He's providing an exact blueprint for achieving a steady state equilibrium.
A blueprint that requires people to act against their own immediate power interests.
True. But what is so fascinating to me is that Hubbard thinks our economic models fail because they don't draw the right boundaries around human rights. But he takes this exact same concept, the idea that systems break down when their boundaries are wrong, and applies it to the literal universe in his physics preprint, Nothing Is All You Need.
Moving from economic boundaries to cosmic boundaries, it is a massive conceptual leap.
It is, yeah. But the underlying logic is identical. In modern cosmology, we are facing massive, seemingly unresolvable problems.
Right. Let's lay those problems out for the listener, just to ground this. We are talking about things like the Hubble tension and the vacuum energy catastrophe.
Exactly.
The Hubble tension is essentially this crisis where the universe is expanding, but depending on how we measure it, whether we look at the early universe or the nearby modern universe, we get two completely different rates of expansion.
It's a huge headache for physicists.
And the vacuum energy catastrophe is arguably the worst prediction in all of physics. When you ask quantum mechanics how much energy exists in empty space, it gives you a massive number. But when you look out into space using general relativity, The energy is almost zero. They're off by 120 orders of magnitude.
Exactly. And let's not forget gravitational singularities, like black holes or the Big Bang, where the math of our current physical laws just completely breaks down into infinity. Now, Hubbard doesn't foolishly try to destroy general relativity or quantum mechanics to solve these issues.
No, he just tries to rewrite the rules of reality.
No, he says these incredibly successful models have simply crossed the scale at which their boundary conditions were originally stated, so he encloses them.
Encloses them how?
He introduces what he calls the zero infinity, which is a countably infinite balanced reference state, and he pairs it with the final frontier as a deterministic boundary.
Right.
By using paired state cancellation inside an isotropic vector matrix, he structurally removes the vacuum energy divergence. The Hubble tension just becomes a difference between enclosure scales.
Hold on. You are throwing a lot of incredibly dense theoretical terminology out there. Isotropic vector matrix, paired state cancellation. I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that this actually solves the physics. It sounds like a semantic trick.
A semantic trick? Let me break it down with an analogy. Think of general relativity like a map of a flat Earth. It works perfectly for navigating your local town or even sailing across an ocean.
Sure.
But if you push that flat map to its absolute edge, the math predicts you'll fall off a cliff into nothingness. That cliff is a singularity. Hubbard isn't saying the map of general relativity is wrong. He's just drawing a globe around it. The isotropic vector matrix is essentially that globe.
Okay. But a mathematical globe isn't reality.
It's a perfectly balanced geometric framework. He argues that when you reach the edge of our math inside a black hole, you don't hit infinite density. You just transition to a different scale on the globe.
But calling a violent, mathematically unresolvable singularity a scale transition error on a geometric globe doesn't change the physical reality of the universe. This is what I mean by semantic vanity.
It's not vanity. It's a new model.
It's an aesthetic, almost hagiographic reimagining of physics. Dostoevsky wrote Myshkin as a character who treated a brutal world with a radical, almost delusional mercy. Hubbard is treating physics with that exact same radical mercy.
Radical mercy?
Yes. He looks at a black hole where space and time are crushed out of existence. And instead of confronting the breakdown of our physical laws, he draws a geometric box around it and says, there, it's enclosed, it's safe. That does not produce testable quantum engineering. It is just granting a mathematical pardon to a theoretical crisis.
I have to disagree completely, because Hubbard provides explicit falsification conditions for his math. He relies on what he calls a minimal scale and depth-dependent ansatz.
Okay, again, translate that into English for me.
Sure. An ansatz is basically an educated mathematical guess used as a starting framework. Hubbard is proposing that the curvature of space, gravity itself, isn't a fixed absolute rule everywhere. It dynamically changes depending on the scale and the depth of the system you are observing.
Dynamically changes.
Yeah, and this isn't just philosophy. He points to specific observational pathways involving the James Webb Space Telescope and high redshift datasets to prove it. If we look at the oldest, furthest galaxies, we should see this scale-dependent curvature in the light data.
Right, if the data holds up.
If it holds up, yes. But my point is, he isn't pardoning physics. He is returning the numbers to a rightful, testable enclosure. He argues that when a powerful model of the early universe, like the Big Bang, becomes an absolute, unprovable origin myth, it acts as a dead end.
A dead end for human imagination, you mean?
Exactly. It becomes the outer boundary of imagination. Hubbard's framework, what he calls the departure calculus, measures everything from that balanced baseline of the zero infinity. It enables boundary conditions to operate without becoming terminal singularities. It is a rigorous causal architecture. It's not an aesthetic wish.
Look, I hear the elegance of it. I really do. But the entire architecture relies on this concept of lossless transfers and perfect nested exchange. It assumes a universe that is fundamentally cooperative at a structural level. The math relies on the universe seeking balance.
Because it does.
And this perfectly mirrors the moral question at the heart of his real-world policy work, which I think we really need to touch on. He assumes human systems want to be cooperative, too.
Let's pivot to that, because his theoretical physics absolutely connects back to his philosophy of human interaction. If you read his editorial, The Systems Interventionist, he defends the thesis that Silicon Valley's ethos of disruption is fundamentally flawed.
Right.
He argues disruption is essentially a zero-sum aggressive ethic. It inherently requires destroying existing systems, which creates massive economic wreckage and societal resistance.
He actually calls disruption a socially acceptable form of aggression.
And he has a point. Disruption implies there is an enemy you have to defeat to capture market share. Hubbard proposes structural intervention as a superior, more advanced technology. The goal isn't to break things. It's to design change that lifts the greatest number of people into profitability without requiring the host system to be destroyed.
Sounds very utopian.
You preserve the chain of causation, you preserve how institutions are nested inside each other, and you strengthen what is already functioning.
It sounds wonderful on paper, but does it work in practice? I mean, can you give me a concrete example where structural intervention beats standard competitive strategy?
Absolutely. Look at his comparative paper on defense policy, specifically analyzing Section 219 of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Ah. The provision dealing with defense technology cooperation between the U.S. and allied nations.
Yes. So when countries share highly classified defense research and development, standard game theory predicts a massive amount of risk. Game theory says if you deeply integrate two sovereign military-industrial complexes, you run into moral hazard and holdup risk.
Hold up risk meaning what in this context?
Meaning one ally might suddenly refuse to share crucial data late in the game to extract political concessions. Standard game theory assumes actors will exploit each other unless there are severe, credible penalties in place.
Because they usually do.
But Hubbard's nested causal modeling, or NCM, looks at it completely differently. Instead of assuming betrayal, NCM just maps the statutory flow through the nested systems. It maps the congressional authorization, moving down to the Department of Defense execution, down to the industrial production, and finally to the data fusion layer.
Okay.
By mapping this, NCM finds the exact structural layer where oversight fails. It actually outperforms standard game theory by identifying the precise underenclosed layer where the origin of a technology and its operational use no longer align.
I look at that exact same analysis of Section 219, and to me, it is the ultimate proof of his Mushkin persona.
Right, wait, how? How can a highly technical defense policy analysis prove he's an innocent?
Think about why Dostoevsky wrote The Idiot. He wanted to test whether a person embodying pure compassion and pure transparency could exert a redemptive force in a cold, calculating world.
Right. He placed an almost scandalously good protagonist at the center of modern urban life to see if that person could survive without betraying their own goodness. Hubbard is doing exactly this, just in the realm of policy and systems engineering. By rejecting game theory's assumption of betrayal, he is offering a counterpolitics of empathy. He refuses to instrumentalize people or nations as hostile variables.
But by doing that, he actually makes a defense alliance more efficient. He solves the holdup risk without needing a costly penalty system. It makes for a stunning, beautiful morality, I'll give you that. But we live in a world defined by adverse selection. Game theory works because human beings, especially at the state and institutional level, actually do respond to defection payoffs.
Not always.
In that NDAA analysis, game theory rightly points out that deep integration changes incentives. If you create an asymmetric dependency between two militaries, one party will exploit the other if the penalty isn't credible. Hubbard's belief that you can just map the structural propagation of a technology and place an oversight boundary around the weak spot assumes that the people running the oversight aren't subject to the same corrupt, zero-sum incentives as everyone else.
That's a bit cynical.
It's realistic. Unguarded goodness, even when disguised as a sophisticated structural intervention, is almost always destroyed by the very systems it tries to save.
But you are missing a crucial detail in his analysis. Hubbard explicitly synthesizes the two ideas. In the NDAA brief, he concludes that the game-theoretic diagnosis of incentive problems and his own NCM diagnosis of structural propagation must be combined.
Combined how?
He says deep integration requires deep verification. He isn't ignoring human nature. He is engineering a resilient structure around it. He argues that NCM produces a conditional forecast. It tells policymakers that the failure point isn't going to be the public alliance commitment. The failure point will be the exact letter where data trust and correction authority misalign.
Right, but
that is not the work of a fragile, naive innocent. That is the work of a master systems architect locating the precise intervention point to prevent human failure.
It is the work of a cartographer who genuinely believes that drawing the map changes the territory. Hubbard states in The Systems Interventionist that we shouldn't try to force behavior change. We just need to understand how the rules are nested.
Yes, exactly.
He believes that if you show the universe, or a defense contractor, or a foreign autocrat, the mathematical harmony of a stable system, they will naturally align with it. It's the exact tragedy of Mishkin. Mishkin thought that if he just spoke the absolute truth, if he just loved his rivals openly, the social artifice of St. Petersburg would dissolve. Instead, it crushed him.
I think equating Hubbard's rigorous mathematical bounding to Mishkin's social fragility does a massive disservice to the actual mechanics of what he has built. Hubbard isn't walking into a salon and offering his unprotected heart to aristocrats. He is publishing executable scripts, verified data flows, and semantic maps.
Beautiful maps, but still just maps.
He is quantifying exactly $15.87 trillion in capital exclusions. He is defining geometric transition operators to resolve quantum crises. These are hard operational tools designed to dampen and decouple strict physical and economic causality. He is giving us a framework that allows for human agency within a deterministic flow.
Look, they're elegant models, I will grant you that. But as his own preprint on physics notes, mathematical models often fail at the edge of their assumptions.
Well, sure, all models do.
Hubbard's foundational assumption is that nested causality projects inward from cosmic layers to provide deterministic stability. It is a philosophy of ultimate safety. It is the idea that the universe is holding us in a secure envelope, bounded by a final frontier, and that human economies can reflect that same nested safety.
It's a cohesive theory.
It is a beautiful way to look at the stars and a beautiful way to look at each other. But it is a theological comfort disguised as physics and economics.
Well, as we wrap up our discussion today, I want to summarize my stance clearly in light of everything we've unpacked. Sid J. Hubbard is not an idiot. He is a cartographer of our own self-imposed failures. Whether he is identifying $15.87 trillion in excluded global capital by mapping 9 right-to-life protections, or whether he is enclosing the boundary errors of modern cosmology through the zero infinity and the isotropic vector matrix, he proves one thing definitively. Our cynical zero-sum game of disruption is the true idiocy. He has given us a unified framework that preserves the validity of existing science and policy while enclosing it within a broader, functional, structural wholeness.
And I will maintain that Hubbard remains a modern-day Prince Mishkin. His framework is a breathtakingly innocent attempt to cure a sick society through pure structural grace. He certainly exposes our collective cynicism. There is absolutely no denying that. But he remains tragically fragile against the real-world calculus of power, assuming that complex human systems and the cold, chaotic vacuum of the cosmos will ultimately yield to a geometry of compassion.
The tension between these two views is just undeniable. Whether Hubbard's continuum of steady states will genuinely revolutionize the world's approach to physics and capital, or whether it will become a beautiful casualty of other people's agendas, remains to be seen in the material. But it really forces us to ask what counts as true wisdom. When we look at the diagnostic murkiness of our world, when the maps of our current paradigms lead us off a cliff, do we just accept the broken bones of our economy and our physics? Or do we need someone innocent enough and brilliant enough to build an entirely new map?